All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Good morning.
Welcome to Canyon County and for our second case of the day from the Idaho Supreme Court. We will hear argument in State of Idaho versus Nicholas Oldenburg. Mr. Oldenburg is represented by Justin Curtis, appealing here today, and the state represented by Ken Jorgensen. Gentlemen, do either of you have any preliminary matters?
I
don't
know.
Very good.
Mr. Curtis.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. This case concerns the district court's denial of Mr. Oldenburg's unopposed motion to seal this criminal case file pursuant to Idaho Code 67-3004, subsection 10. And in 2018, the legislature amended the statute to provide that a person who has had all of his charges dismissed may have the official court file thereof sealed. So in the Ada County District Court, Mr. Oldenburg moved pursuant to the statute to have his case sealed. He asserted that the language of the statute plainly applied to his case because he had had his cases dismissed. The state did not oppose that motion. And in a subsequent order that nevertheless denied the motion, the district court also agreed that Mr. Oldenburg had met the requirements of the statute. On appeal, the state has not asserted otherwise. The state has not challenged the district court's determination that Mr. Oldenburg has met the language of the statute. And so our position is that this case is quite simple, that he met the requirements of the statute, and therefore the district court should have granted his motion. So in this case, as I say, the statute provides that if you've had all your charges dismissed, a defendant may have the official court file thereof sealed. And in this case, Mr. Oldenburg was charged with 13 counts of sexual exploitation of child, pursuant to a plea agreement involving two other cases. Every charge in this case was dismissed. So therefore, the district court properly held that Mr. Oldenburg met the requirements of the statute, and I would ask this court to agree with that. The second thing that the district court agreed with Mr. Oldenburg was that this statute was non-discretionary, and that even though it uses the term may have the court file thereof sealed, that the term may there conferred a right to Mr. Oldenburg to file such a motion. And the court compared it to language saying that the court may grant a motion, which would be more discretionary. And the court compared this to the phrase in the notice of appeal rule that says a defendant may file a notice of appeal, and determined that that conferred a substantive right to him to have his court file, sort of to move to have the court file sealed. Again, the state did not contest that down below. The state has not contested that part on appeal either.
Mr. Curtis, I took the district court's opinion on page 97 of the record to point out that he viewed Rule 32I in the statute as codependent, and that your client's position below was that they were not, that 67-3004-10 is independent of 32I. And I guess that, to me, begs the question then, so does Mr. Oldenburg just go back, if we were to affirm this decision, and say, I hereby move under 67-3004-10 and 32I. All of a sudden now we're good? Is that how you read that? Or do you think that, I mean, I get your point. The statute's clear. It's mandatory. But is there a place for 32I, and do you have to cite that authority to be able to give the court the imprimatur, go ahead and do what was being requested?
That's not something I considered, Your Honor. Because as you know, if they took the position down below that this was not filed pursuant to ICAR 32, and they were proceeding solely in the statute. I think the difference between Rule 32 and in this case is that 32I, of course, provides discretion for the court
to seal whatever
or not, and to provide, you know, provide the justifications for does the public interest outweigh the right to privacy, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't know that just mentioning the rule would then allow the court. I mean, our position is they don't need the rule at all,
right?
But I'm not sure that citing the rule would solve that problem, because as I say, the rule itself does not apply. Mr. Oldenburg is seeking essentially an invocation of a non-discretionary statute. So Mr. Oldenburg could file a Rule 32I motion and subject himself to the discretion of the court, but the argument that he's making and wants to make is that he's applying under the statute and the statute provides that it's not discretionary with the court when he does get relief.
And Mr. Curtis, can you speak to the separation of powers issue? Because I also read the same page of the district court's decision. He not only cites Rule 32, he also cites Article 5, Section 2 of the Constitution that gives the Supreme Court constitutional authority over the integrated court system. So although the district court doesn't come out and say, I'm seeing a separation of powers issue, I read that paragraph in his order on the record, page 97, as saying Supreme Court has authority over these records, and so you have to work with the court's rules when you seek to employ this remedy.
So, first of all, I am going to disagree that that is what the court is ultimately holding here. And I say that because prior to citing Article 5, Section 2, the court cites a separate or a different statute, which is 67-3003, subsection 2. It says, rules relating to information maintained and reported by the court shall be made after consultation with and approval by the Idaho Supreme Court.
Right, and then he goes on, after he cites the Constitution, to say it's difficult to see how the department could implement rules without approval of the Supreme Court.
And then, as I say, I interpret that as the court saying that it has doubts that the department could order the court to seal the records. But that's not an issue in this case. Mr. Oldenburg has not asked the department to seal anything. He's filed his motion with the court, with the appropriate authority to do that. And so I think that's what the court is saying, that it expresses doubt that the department has control over court records, not that the legislature lacks authority to pass a statute in this regard. And when you look at the subsequent paragraph, it says, absent rules made with the approval of the Idaho Supreme Court, which is exactly the phrase in 67-3003, subsection 2. So I think what the court is really getting at is that there's a separate statute here that provides for this rule approved by the Idaho Supreme Court, and that's what the court is relying on. And I think that's a mistake, because that existed prior to the amendment of the statute. That rule is about what this rule covered prior, which is fingerprinting and identification procedures done by the state police, not the court file. And so once the legislature changed the rule to allow for a court file to be sealed, that is an amendment to the statute that supersedes 67-3003, subsection 2. But I will note, I mean, the state has asserted essentially a separation of powers in response, but it cites Article 5, Section 13, separation of powers in the substantive versus procedural context. And I would note that at no point does the court cite Article 5, Section 13. At no point does the court use the phrase, in this case, separation of powers. At no point does the district court go through any analysis of a substantive law versus a procedural one, whether or not they conflict.
Well, let me pivot off that for just a second. We talk about substantive laws and procedural laws, and I'm wondering about the Idaho Court Administrative Rules for just a second. When I was an attorney, I'm hard-pressed to think if I ever cited an Idaho Court Administrative Rule in any motion or brief that I filed. I wasn't even hardly aware of them until I became a judge, and suddenly I was extremely aware of them. And I'm just wondering about the propriety of requiring attorneys as a key to open the door to the court to cite our administrative rules when it's an area that's not even covered by our rules of criminal procedure. I guess what I'm saying, are all rules created equal? I mean, it'd be one thing if an attorney was asking for a criminal Rule 35 motion and didn't cite criminal Rule 35. I could see that might be fatal. But the failure to cite an administrative rule, is that entitled to the same effect?
I'm not sure I still understand the
question. I'm trying to throw you a softball. I'm just wondering, do the administrative rules of procedure carry the same weight as the criminal rules of procedure?
Well, I mean, to the extent that they conflict,
I'm not necessarily talking about them being in conflict. I'm talking about them being a necessary thing, a key to the courthouse, a key to getting your motion granted, is that you cite the appropriate rule, even if it's a court administrative rule.
Well, perhaps not, but the court administrative rule sets forth obviously what the court can and cannot do, and a lot of the administrative rules are not even discretionary, or really Rule 32G, for instance, in this case, just says, like, these are sealed regardless. So
don't they generally cover internal processes
of
the court?
Yes, they do.
They don't apply externally to, like, attorneys and litigants citing those to get certain results, usually.
As a general rule, yes.
But in this instance, doesn't Rule 32 speak to when the public can access court records, when a litigant can ask to have court records sealed?
Yes, as I say, in this case, under Rule 32I, 32I provides that it must be done by motion. So, yes, to the extent the rules do govern internal procedure, largely, I would acknowledge that 32I requires a motion with the court, and then discretionary decisions of the court in analyzing whether or not to grant that motion or not. But to get back to your separation of powers question, Justice Sahn, it's our position here that the legislature can pass substantive laws, but it can't interfere with the court's procedure. And this is a clearly substantive law. The district court, I think, found it, said that Mr. Oldenburg had a substantive right to have this case sealed pursuant to the statute. And so if there's a conflict between court rules and a statute, if it's a substantive law, the statute will prevail. If it's a procedural one, the rule will prevail. And it's our position that this is a substantive law, and therefore there's no separation of powers issue with regard to that, because it does give Mr. Oldenburg a substantive right to have his case sealed.
And so how far does that principle go? I mean, if somebody starts moving to strike things, because leaving this in the record that's not true may affect my substantive rights, does the legislature get to direct when the court has to strike things from the record?
Well, I say, I mean, in this case, we're talking about the entire file, right? So,
right,
in this instance, yes. I think in your question, that does get more to closer to, like procedural mechanisms within the court that a procedural rule tends to deal with.
And the point I'm trying to draw out is I understand your argument. It seems like a slippery slope to me to say you can pass laws that deal with records and these go to substantive rights and others go to procedural, and the struggle with trying to identify when is it procedural and when is it substantive, particularly when it's one branch of government telling another branch of government this is what you need to do with your records.
Yeah, well, as I said here, I think it's pretty clear that the legislature's intent of this was to protect criminal defendants who have had their cases dismissed as a matter of public policy, and therefore that is clearly a substantive right. When we're talking about more about, I want sentence stricken from a motion or something, or sentence stricken from the order, I mean, that's obviously not clearly, that's not provided by a statute yet, so it's a hypothetical in any event. But I mean, like, the closer a statute gets toward regulating the court's internal procedures, the more of an issue there is going to be. But if we get back to the defendant in this instance, that's just not a concern. This court should pass.
So if the legislature passes a law that contains a policy, are we obligated as a court to amend our rules to respond to that policy?
Well, it would depend, again, I guess it would depend on whether it's a substantive policy or a procedural one, I think, Your Honor. And then this court has explained, what is, substantive, what is procedural. So to the extent that the legislature wants to alter the rules of evidence, for example, and provide for different hearsay rules or whatever, this court has said, well, no. The court passes the rules of evidence, and that provides, procedure for admitting evidence in the court. And so in that sense, that would trump it. So if there is a conflict, that's when you determine whether or not something is procedural or substantive or not. If it is substantive, then yes, I think the legislature gets to set forth what those substances are, but if it's procedural, then no.
Is there a conflict between the rule and the statute?
No, there's not, Your Honor. There's never one argued down below. I don't think the district court found one. The state has acknowledged that they're not in their brief.
They said they were not necessarily...
Not necessarily conflicting, yes. but no, I mean, it's the statute is broader than Criminal Rule 32 is, but it is not in conflict with Rule 32. Rule 32 does not say that these records cannot be sealed, in which case that would be a clear conflict with the statute. And so just because the rule, or the statute broadens the rule, I don't think means that it's in conflict with the show. And so ultimately, it is our position here today that the district court erred in determining that it did not have authority. Well, I would also point out that if I recognize it's not binding by this court at all, that's not necessarily the holding in the Clapp case. But the Court of Appeals in Clapp noted that in dicta that Clapp may have a viable opportunity to seal his record under a separate statute, which is this one here. With that statement in the Court of Appeals case, Mr. Clapp filed a motion just like Mr. Oldenburg did in his case. The state did not appeal it or did not challenge it there. Judge Hoagland granted that motion. That case did not show up on the repository as far as I can tell. So we do know that this is something that courts can do. We know this because a court has done it before. So I don't think we can say that the court is essentially without any mechanism to do this. Courts can grant motions to seal. They do it under Rule 32 repeatedly. Nothing changes with regard to this. As I say, it's our position that the court is really relying on 67-3003 subsection 2 and uses that exact language in saying that it thinks it needs a court rule in order to effectuate the statute. As I say, the court never said that the statute was unconstitutional. But it's our position that 3003 subsection 2, obviously it predates this amendment. It applies to the original subject matter of Title 67. And to the extent it conflicts with the new amended statutes, the new statute controls as it is more recent.
So what do we make of the second sentence of 67-3003 sub 2 that says, rules relating to information maintained and reported by the court shall be made after consultation with and approval by the Idaho Supreme Court?
Well, I think it means that ultimately this court, under the prior section of the statute, would pass a court rule dealing with, let's say, the subject matter of the statute, which was the fingerprint and identification mechanism. This isn't a case where, as I say, I don't dispute the court's ultimate conclusion or its speculation that the state police cannot dictate to this court what its rule should be. And so had that statute said, the state police must also sign off on it or something, that would be a problem. But this just says consultation with an approval by the court. So I think, the approval by this court is still what matters. But as I say, our point is that was superseded by the subsequent amendments to the statute. And unless the court has any other further questions, I would just ask
before you. The rules, the noun there in the second sentence, the first noun, rules, whose rules? Our rules, or whose rules are we talking about?
So it's rules relating to information reported by the court. So I think it's, this court's rules.
Isn't it the department's rules? The department's rules relating to information maintained and reported by the court shall be made after consultation with and approval by the Idaho Supreme Court. The first sentence is...
That's a good point. That's a good point. I have not read that way before, but I think it's correct. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, sir.
May it please the court. I have this strange urge to ask Justice Stegner to state his name and spell his last name.
I got the kids' table.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an unusual layout. For one thing, I'm higher than the court. This is very strange for me. I'll have to adjust. Anyway, may it please the court. The issue in this case is not exactly straightforward. I realize my good friend here has said that it is. The state's position it is not, and I understand that the party with the more complicated argument is somewhat of a disadvantage, so I hope to be able to answer any questions you have about some of this. But anyway, the facts really here are not in dispute. Mr. Oldenburg had all of the charges in this particular case dismissed as part of a universal plea agreement that involved other cases. And right away, you can kind of tell by the language of the statute that we're outside something that the legislature contemplated here. You know, it appears that they're talking about innocent people in the first place, but their language doesn't say that, and I'm not arguing that. The actual language of the statute is any person who was arrested or served a criminal summons and who has had all charges dismissed, and the state acknowledges that does fit Mr. Oldenburg's case on the strict facts, may have the official court file thereof sealed. There's been some discussion of the word may. The state is not arguing that that is a discretionary grant to the court. That is talking about what the person may do, not what the court may or may not do. So this, the statutory language, the district court ultimately concluded, well, Mr. Oldenburg falls within the statutory language. The state's really not disputing any of that. So we start with the idea that the legislature has granted this right to have judicial records sealed. However, this is where it becomes complicated. And that is, what is the legislature's control over this court's records? The state is not advocating that the statute is necessarily unconstitutional. There's that word again, necessarily. I realize that I have hedged a little bit on some of these things. But certainly the legislature has some say in court records. The legislature can ask the court system, the separate branch of government, to maintain or not maintain or do certain things with its records. And the state isn't even necessarily saying that sealing is beyond the power of the legislature. However, I think that the constitutional construct is rather clear here, which is that this court has primacy over its records. It has the ultimate primary control. And its only statement on sealing records comes in the form of Idaho Court Administrative Rule 32I. And this is where it gets a little bit interesting, just in the standpoint of there's no direct conflict between the statute and the rule. However, Mr. Oldenburg is simply not entitled to any relief whatsoever under the rule. The rule does not provide for sealing in his circumstances, dismissal of charges. In fact, the rule requires a written finding of one of six things that... I am getting old. Highly intimate facts or statements, libelous, compromise financial or physical safety of certain parties, endanger life, preserve fair trial, or personal data identifiers. So the rule says nothing whatsoever about sealing in the instances of Mr. Oldenburg's case. So it's not technically in conflict. The rule just says nothing about this. It grants no power to the court to seal on this basis. Only the statute does that, and that's why Mr. Oldenburg below and on appeal has taken the view that, well, 32I has nothing to do with this. Why? Because if we apply 32I, he's entitled to nothing. He is not entitled to seal his documents. So there isn't an overt conflict here. But there's kind of an implied conflict just in the sense that this court's rule does not grant what the statute grants. And therefore, it comes down strictly to the idea that can the legislature impose this requirement on the courts without this court's approval? And that's where we get to the district court's opinion, which basically says no. Without some sort of enacting rule by this court, the legislature can't unilaterally mandate sealing under these types of circumstances, or really any type of circumstances. So, absent some enacting rule, the statute is of no effect until this court effectively endorses that through passing a rule. So that's what the district court said, and the district court is right. It's not really my job or the attorney general's job to protect this court's role within the Constitution. And it's often my job to defend what the legislature has done. So I feel like I'm in a divorce case right now, and I'm the child, and you know, the dispute is between parents, so to speak, just in the sense that the legislature has said this, and I'm not saying the legislature can't say this, but the court does have primacy in this area.
Your statements on me beg the question, so I'm going to ask it. Do you have a conflict of interest?
No, I don't. I don't believe I do. I think that, quite frankly, in looking at my role in all of this, and I try to perceive that as humbly as possible. It is to provide an argument for the state of Idaho. So that will usually involve making an argument on behalf of the district court, because that is my statutory role, is to come to this court and argue basically on behalf of a district court opinion, if that district court opinion is defensible within my ethical boundaries. So I don't believe I have a conflict of interest. I think it would be possible for somebody, for me or somebody in my position, to come and argue to this court that a statute is in fact unconstitutional. However, obviously, that would have to be done after looking at pretty closely at the role of the Attorney General and what that role really is. So, and that's one of the reasons why I haven't argued but I would argue if I thought it were really applicable. I would argue, yes, this statute is totally 100% unconstitutional, you should strike it, if I thought that was the right outcome. I don't think that that's necessarily the right outcome. I think that what we have here is a legislative statement on what these court records should be that this court ultimately can say yay or nay to.
And isn't that really what 67-3003 sub 2 is a nod to?
I think it is. I think it is the legislative recognition that this court has authority in relation to its records. And in fact, the amendment is kind of odd, because if you go all the way back to the definitions under the chapter 1 of the definitions, I mean, the whole chapter is named Criminal History Records and Crime Information. And then it defines criminal history records to not include any court records whatsoever. So as this statute was originally written, the court was entirely out of it, except as approving ISP rules about what records it would and would not share and give with the court system. And so the legislature in the original draft recognized that this court has authority over its own records. It exempted court records from the legislation entirely. It said that ISP can't pass any regulations that would affect the court without the court's approval. And then in 2018, we get this little thing dropped in there, and apparently without consideration of some of the things that went into the original legislation and some of the considerations that went into it about the court's prerogatives. So under the circumstances, the district court did the right thing. It said, you know, look, the legislature has told me that we should do this, has said that the courts should do this. However, this is a constitutional prerogative of the court system, a separate branch of government, and the legislature doesn't have unilateral power to come in and tell the courts what to do with its own records.
So I want to come back to the chief's question to Mr. Curtis. If Mr. Oldenburg had moved pursuant to the statute and Administrative Rule 32I, couldn't he have argued one of those bases for sealing should allow him to seal pursuant to the statute and the rule?
No. If I were to draw a Venn diagram of this statute and Venn diagram of this rule, that'd be on opposite sides of the sheet. They don't overlap in any way, shape, or form. The rule simply does not speak to this whatsoever. It does grant the court fairly broad powers, but only in limited circumstances. Broad discretion, but in only limited circumstances. This court has struck a very fine balance between the constitutional duty of public records by this court and the need to keep those records from the public. And in crafting that, it did not include anything that would say you can keep these records off. You know, the dismissals are suddenly no longer of public interest.
Right, but they're not mutually exclusive, are they? For example, given the statement in the statute, couldn't he come in and argue under 32I2C that if you leave these publicly available, the dissemination or publication of them could compromise my financial security or reasonably result in economic or financial loss of power?
I think that's actually fairly tenuous, but let's just assume that it could fall within that. The statute clearly says something different than what that rule says. The statute says that this person, upon dismissal, this person may come in and seal the records. That's it. That's end of story. So first off, there's no showing. There's no showing in the statute required for compromise of financial security. And also, the rule, unlike the statute, grants the court discretion. So, no, I would not say those are the same things.
And I'm not saying they're the same things, but I'm saying, couldn't someone argue this statute says I get to have my record sealed because I meet the circumstances, the charges were dismissed, they haven't been refiled, and I also satisfy one or more of the conditions in Rule 32I, and here's why.
But the problem with that is the statute would impose no burden of proof on Mr. Oldenburg other than to show that the charges were dismissed. The rule would impose a burden of proof on him to show a compromise of financial security. I don't know if Mr. Oldenburg's still in prison, but he might. There's nothing in this record that would suggest he could meet that burden, and he certainly never tried. So it isn't just a matter of citing the rule and the statute, and suddenly the statute becomes effective. It's got to be a direct incorporation of the statute by the rule. It's got to be something in a rule that says we're giving effect to this statute, and yes, if your charges are dismissed, under the statute, you get to have everything sealed. And that's what we're really lacking, not just a citation to 32I.
Why do you need the statute to effectuate the rule? Let's assume that just the opposite happened. Let's say a motion was filed pursuant to Rule 32I. And there was evidence asserted and provided in the record showing that whatever criteria for 32I relief was met. Could the court essentially have granted the same thing that the statute would provide?
Essentially, yes, but not necessarily on the same grounds. We've been talking about that.
Two different roads that lead to the same place, aren't they?
Potentially, but I would say that that's not really unique. And the fact that at the point we're proposing hypotheticals, if Mr. Oldenburg hypothetically could meet the standards of the rule, he could theoretically, yes. But it would require a different showing than under the statute.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's not that he couldn't cite the statute in a Rule 32I motion, and it's not like he can't cite 32I in a statutory motion. The problem is there's really no overlap between those things such that the statute gives effect, that the rule gives effect to the statute. And so this court can clearly pass rules about sealing its documents. The legislature's prerogatives in sealing this court's records is not so vast. And the district court properly held that without something by this court saying, yes, we are accepting the legislature's statute that allows the sealing of the record, we will allow our records to be sealed in this fashion. The statute's effectively a nullity until that happens. And so the district court correctly denied the motion, and whether this court does or does not adopt the rule, we have no position on that. Our position is only that such a rule is essential before this statute has the effect of binding this or any lower court to do what the statute says.
So Mr. Oldenburg doesn't get the benefit of the statute?
No, he does not, because until this court will allow its records to be sealed in this fashion, the statute is merely a legislative guidance, I think is the way I would put it, for lack of a better term. The legislature clearly wants records sealed in this case, but this court is the one who ultimately determines whether they will be.
And I realize you find yourself in an unusual position defending our rule and attacking the statute, but I'm curious to know how you respond to the question of how any of these arguments have been preserved.
Well, I think they're preserved. Interestingly enough, the district court did this sua sponte. So there's no preservation in the arguments of the parties, really. It's mostly in the actual ruling of the district court. And I would submit that the argument that the state is making on this is entirely consistent with that argument. It's another reason why I wouldn't make the statute is unconstitutional argument, because clearly the district court didn't do that, and the state never took that position, so that would be an unpreserved issue. However, is a rule necessary for effectuation of this statute, I believe, is properly preserved in this decision by the district court, and therefore the arguments made, which expand on that, or you know, depending on your view, maybe don't make it as well. I think they're entirely consistent with that ruling or preserved by the ruling and the analysis of the district court itself.
Assuming it was completely sua sponte, isn't there still an obligation to object to it below or seek reconsideration or something along those lines?
I think that's an interesting question, just in the sense that, you know, if you have an actual ruling by a district court, we've done away with the idea that you have to take exception to that before you can preserve something for appeal. So certainly you can't expand beyond what the district court actually decided, and we can't, neither of us, I believe, can argue beyond the scope of what the district court did or did not decide. However, we have not made the argument. The appellant's arguments are outside the scope of that, and I also believe that our arguments are within that scope. So I do not believe that there are preservation issues in the way that this case has been presented to this court, and that the district court's ruling itself does preserve the arguments of both parties. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, sir. How much time does Mr. Curtis have remaining?
12 minutes, Your Honor.
Sir?
You, I'll try to be brief. I'm going to admit to some confusion here now. And that is, the state has specifically said it is not alleging the statute is unconstitutional. It is not asserting that the legislature cannot act in this regard. And it would be our position that if the statute is not unconstitutional, then this court's duty is simply to follow the language of the statute. I'm not aware of advisory statutes to this court or in any other circumstance. So if in fact the statute violates separation of powers, it would be unconstitutional. But based on the arguments that were just made, the state has asserted that it is not unconstitutional and that it does not violate separation of powers. And so if that's the case, I think this court just applies the law as is written. As I say, that it's our position that this is a substantive rule in any event. If the court does consider a separation of powers issue, and if it is a substantive rule, the court's duty is just to apply it.
Isn't it really, though, not an issue of constitutionality, but an issue of operationality, that absent a rule, the law doesn't go into operation?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, like, that would still mean that it's an entirely null... Essentially, that you'd be saying the legislature has told the court to do this, but the court can't do it until it decides to do it.
I don't think it's a matter of deciding to do it. It's deciding how to do it, right? I mean, like, for example, the law required the police to do certain things and others to do certain things to make the law operational. And so was there any duty on this court to take certain action to make the law operational? I think that's what Judge Miller concluded.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, because as I say, to the extent that the statute requires rules to be made, it's rules necessary for the implementation of the chapter. And in this case, that's not the case. Like if a court record is to be sealed, the only person that can do that is the judge. So the defendant files a motion. We know under Rule 32, courts know how to deal with motions to seal. So that's the only procedural mechanism that could possibly exist would be just a motion to file with the court. It's a very different thing when it comes to the state police, where you do need rules about what department is actually the custodian of these records, who do you apply to in the state police to have this done. There are necessary rules there because the state police is obviously a much bigger executive agency, different departments that you don't need to, you need to know where you're taking your paperwork to be made. And in the district court file, there's only one option, and that's to file a motion with the court. And so I don't think any rulemaking here is necessary. If we're going to say that the statute is constitutional, if this is within the legislature's authority, the only thing that can happen is the defendant has an opportunity to move to have it done, and the only way to do that is to file a motion with the court. And that's what we're asking this court to hold today. Unless there are any further questions, we would ask that this court reverse.
Thank you very much, sir. Counsel, thank you to both of you. This matter is now under advisement. We render a decision accordingly. We'll be in recess until approximately 11:00.